This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a school choice advocate joins us to make a case for allocating more state funds toward private voucher schools. First, a 2022 Pew study found Wisconsin residents who take out short-term payday loans deal with some of the highest costs across the country. Madison's branch of the nonprofit Society of St. Vincent de Paul is the latest group now attempting an alternate microloan program to traditional payday lenders. We'd like to know if you've borrowed from a payday lender before, and we'd love to have you share your experience with us. And wondering what your changes you'd like to see in short-term microloan business. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Julie Bennett, who's the executive director of the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul. And Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Lee. It's a true pleasure to be here.
Also joining us this afternoon, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and human ecology, where he is also the Fetzer Family Chair in Consumer and Personal Finance. He's also faculty director of the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And Julie, I'll begin with you today and give us an idea of what made your branch of the St. Vincent de Paul decide to try this microloan program.
This is a program that we've seen be successful in helping people who are coping with poverty and a couple of other places in the country who have been doing this for a number of years. Columbus, Ohio, and Dallas and North Texas really have seen the effect, not just of helping people avoid payday loans or get out from under payday loans, but also to develop a banking relationship. What they see is that access to money gives people a step up.
And Michael, give us some idea of the impact, the role that payday loan businesses play in the communities and the impact that they have.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, when somebody needs a payday loan, it's because it's not because they're doing it because they really want to. It's because they have to. They're out of money. And, you know, maybe there's a bill due. Maybe the rent's due. Maybe they're looking at a late fee. So, you know, it's oftentimes something they're using as sort of a last-ditch effort to try to get by. Yet, you know, in Wisconsin, we see a lot of families are in this position where they've, you know, either the income didn't come in this particular week or month that they expected, or the expenses are further beyond what they can handle. And, you know, oftentimes this is the last resort, the only way to get by are these short-term loans.
So what's the impact of families then when they take out these short-term loans and then face some of the highest interest rates across the country in Wisconsin when they work to pay them back?
Yeah, the traditional payday loans, not the types of loans that the St. Vincent de Paul is doing,
right,
and other, you know, really responsible lenders are doing. Oftentimes what happens is people come into these with the best of intention. Maybe they borrow $500 or $1,000, and they think in 2 weeks, I got this. I'll get things back on track. I'll pay this off, and it'll be fine. 2 weeks comes, and actually all they can really do is pay the interest payment on that. So, you know, they just pay whatever that interest payment might be. Maybe it's $15 or $20, whatever it is. And they think, well, in two more weeks, I'll get this. And they don't. And so they continue to roll that loan over and over and over. And so they may spend $300-$400 on just the interest for what was originally a $500 loan. And that's where you get these really high interest rates that occur because people in the end just are a little too optimistic in terms of what they think they can handle, and they just can't get caught up again. And so a loan that has better terms, where you're actually paying back some of the principal and not just the interest, that can help people get to a position where they can actually pay it off and get back on their feet.
Which brings us to the role that the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul is looking to play in their microloan program in their community. And Julie Bennett, as I understand this, it's not just it's a lot more than a loan, isn't it?
It is. As we're beginning this program, what we see is the opportunity for people to become banked, as I said, but additionally, they will grow their credit score. They will get out of a cash economy, which is both expensive and dangerous, and they'll have the opportunity to work with our members who are the core piece of this on our side to have some ability or some opportunity to gain knowledge in financial literacy, to work with someone regularly on their budget, and to have access to other resources if there's any given month that they can't pay this loan, that they could tap into other resources that we make available in the community through our food pantry, our pharmacy, utility support, other kinds of basic assistance that may free up those dollars to help them make their loan payment as well.
That's Julie Bennett, who directs the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul, also joining us for this conversation. J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison. And you can join the conversation as well as you look to make ends meet and what it takes. What do you see 1-800 in your community? That's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. And Julie, how close are we to opening day and getting this program under a microloan program underway?
We're looking at about 6 weeks at this point. We, our friends over at the Bank of Sun Prairie have been our banking champion in this, and we're finalizing the legal agreement to make this happen. The way it will work is essentially St. Vincent de Paul will have funds on deposit at the bank, and we will qualify individuals for the loans, and then those people who are qualified go to the bank and they get the loan, and the bank will administer the loan, managing the payments and reporting to the credit bureau and those kinds of things.
And Michael Collins, you spoke about the payday loans in their community, but what about microloan systems like this, the one that St. Vincent de Paul is about ready to give a try?
You know, I think this is a fabulous type of approach. I mean, we like to say we should just, you know, raise a magic wand and get rid of payday loans. But the reality is that people still have trouble making ends meet. Only half of households, and it's even only about a third of lower income households, have any kind of emergency savings. So when they have a shortfall, it's really friends or family, or it's taking out an emergency loan. And so having some better alternatives to some of these high costs, payday loans, auto title loans, you know, other kinds of products out there that are expensive and risky, is just a great thing. It pushes, I think, the good providers, the good lenders out there to do better. And in the long run, hopefully it pushes out some of these, you know, worse products that make people worse off.
Yeah, let's go to your calls and questions now as your experience as well. If you would like to share them, please join us, 1-800-642-1234, where we go to Linda in Eau Claire, who joins us this afternoon. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Well, the question I have is, why is it that no one is discussing the usurious interest rates and the greed and avarice of loan companies that prey on low-income people?
Linda, I appreciate the call. And Michael, I will begin with you, but I'd also like to hear what you'd think about this, Julie. But Michael, why does Wisconsin have some of the highest short-term interest rates on payday loans in the country?
You know, this is a choice that our legislators in our state have made. There are other states where the highest interest rates are actually regulated, where the state says, no, you know, you can't have loans at those rates. The argument I've heard among our policymakers in our state is that, well, even if they were to ban it, then people would still find another way to get these loans. They go to an online lender or some sort of other type of loan product that may be not even in the regulated system. So it's better to have it expensive but in the regulated system. I think that's debatable, but that's kind of where we're at as a state. You know, Minnesota is currently contemplating a law that would effectively ban payday loans. So, again, it's a choice that the legislators of our state have made.
And Julie, as I read in at CapTimes.com, you spoke with legislators on both sides of the aisle about payday loans, and what did they have to tell you?
What I heard from legislators on both sides of the aisle is people don't have an alternative to payday lending. You know, Michael alluded to that it is the resource people have when they need immediate access to money. And while that may be true, I'm not willing to accept that as something that has to remain true. We can offer an alternative to payday lending. My hope is that we can show that this is a way that this can be done, and we can be joined by others in the community to create a big enough access between our community banks and our larger banks and our nonprofits. There's enough money to do this. It's just, can we create enough access to the money? And if we can demonstrate a program that works, that becomes replicable, then we create an alternative to payday lending, and then the legislature can take it up from a different perspective.
Hey, Julie, are you able to stick around with us a little bit longer here this afternoon?
Sure.
I'd appreciate that. Yeah, our guest, Julie Bennett, who directs the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul, also joining us, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison. And you're welcome to as well at 1-800-642-1234. If you've had experience with payday lenders, if you'd like to know more about the microloan program that's about to get underway here in Madison, if you've got questions for Julie or Michael, join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our conversation on payday lenders and alternate programs for microlending with our guest, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and human ecology, where he's the Fetzer Family Chair in Consumer and Personal Finance and also the faculty director of the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. And also joining us this afternoon, Julie Bennett, CEO and executive director of the Madison chapter of St. Vincent de Paul, which is looking to get their microloan program underway here in Madison in a matter of weeks. And Michael, I want to ask a little more about how we see the money reverberate through the economy. Why haven't we seen more of these microloan programs that Julie talked about? We've seen in North Texas be successful, in Columbus and Ohio be successful, and we're about ready to see tried out in Madison.
Yeah, I mean, these programs do exist. They, there are some credit unions around the state that have done these. There have been some other nonprofits that have done these. They tend to be relatively small. I think where it's tough is that the big, payday lending companies have the ability to advertise. They have storefronts. They have bus ads. They have lots of ways to get in front of people. And so some of these smaller programs, which are oftentimes, much more in the consumer's benefit, just don't get traction. They don't get the attention. And people end up already in that storefront, already cutting a deal before they realize they have some other option.
Yes, the payday loan companies, they've got billboards, they've got advertising. You make a good point, and you'd want to keep that money in the micro programs for the loans that are available. So, Julie, having said that, now, how do we get people who are interested and in need in the Madison community connected with this micro loan program?
People will start through our member organization. We have members in 18 Catholic churches who visit people in need in their homes to learn about their needs. And as they learn that a payday loan is in someone's life, either they're contemplating one or they're already using one, they will make referrals back to us. We will work with that family to evaluate their ability to repay a loan, and we'll send them to the bank to get that loan. It will be a slow process to start as we learn with them how to do this. We have had great mentoring from Columbus and North Texas, but we live in Madison and we'll have to figure out how to do things the Madison way. But there again, I go back to as we grow, There's a lot of buzz around this. It's an exciting thing. We see other nonprofits already reaching out to us to say we want to help too. And I think if we can generate that buzz and continue to grow the interest and the commitment, which is a big piece, that we will see the money come. And as the money comes and the availability of the loans grows, my hope and my expectation is that takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, there are St. Vincent de Paul chapters throughout Wisconsin and beyond our state borders. So has there been any interest from other St. Vincent de Paul chapters around Wisconsin that are watching what you do, Julie, and maybe following suit?
I think at this point they're watching what we're doing here in Madison. Our district council here in Madison is one of the largest in the nation, and we have capacity to do things in a bigger way than some of the other organizations in the state and across the country, which allows us to have the funds to get this started. But I think there's eyes on to see how it might be replicated, both in Madison with other nonprofits and with St. Vincent de Paul's elsewhere in the state and in the country.
And Michael Collins, you mentioned the economic impact for families, but how do the economic impacts for microloans versus payday loans, high interest loans versus community loans and the community support that St. Vincent de Paul is looking to provide through these microloans, how does that compare?
You know, the anytime that we can keep more money in people's pockets, that benefits the local economy. So, you know, if the alternative is that people are paying overdraft fees, they're paying, you know, hundreds of dollars in interest, and instead that is money that they're able to actually spend on other things that are important to them, or, you know, able to make their ends meet for the other bills that they might have, that helps them. It helps keep their own financial security higher and also keep some of that money local. The fact that this is a local lender and a local loan pool as well, I mean, this is all sort of feeding into our local economy and not only stabilizing families, but keeping some of that capital right here. So, you know, it's hard to put a big number on this, but still, it's going to definitely make a difference for the people who are able to take out these loan products.
And how would other communities begin the process of looking at developing a microloan program in a way that would benefit and ripple through the community like that?
Michael? Did you want me to take that one?
Well, I you both can answer it, but Julie, yeah, if you've got an answer, go ahead and step in.
So step one is truly to have a pot of money. And we have been able to set aside funds, and we have had generous donations that have allowed us to grow that pool of funds that we are able to make available for our loans. Step two is a lending partner, and Bank of Sun Prairie has stepped up to be our first lending partner here, but because we have been able to develop this idea from successful programs elsewhere, three other banks in the community are ready to say, when you are ready, we want to partner with you in this as well. They see the benefit to the community. They see the benefit to the neighbors who will use these programs, and they get to talk about good that they're offering in the community as well. This is a win for everyone, but you have to show that it's viable, because while we at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Madison is taking the financial risk, and we're willing to do that, you know, the bank is taking on administrative costs that for very small loans. They don't make money on these, and they are in business to make money. So they, you know, you have to find somebody willing to be on that side of it. But one of the things that is close to my heart in this is we know that there are people who, if you are living on, you know, $700 or $800 a month in disability income, you will never have the capacity to pay back a loan. We need to look for other solutions for people who can't make that loan payment. And we do that. But for those people who can make that loan payment and don't have access to it, we need to open that door, help them establish a banking relationship, help them not have to pay 10 or 15 or 20% of their income simply to cash their paycheck. And that gives people a step up on that path out of poverty.
Michael, when communities hear about these microloan programs, they are a fraction of the lending in business and industry. And as Julie Bennett mentioned there, there's got to be some financial incentive. But how can you make programs like this grow in communities across the country and here in Wisconsin, where we've got some of the highest payday loan interest rates in the country?
Well, you know, I think there's reason to be optimistic. I mean, we've seen cases where financial products that were considered to be, you know, risky or, you know, outlandish. So like loans for first-time home buyers or loans for small businesses And today they're, you know, they're kind of part and parcel of what many lending institutions do. So definitely there can be these sort of leading edge programs that eventually push the market to be more responsive to the consumer needs and sometimes offering a product that's actually more competitive. And so in the long run, I think these are really important to try to push the market and do some of this, you know, R&D work, if you want to think about it that way, to try to push the market to a better place. Will it happen overnight? No, but that's why we need these kinds of programs to try to show what's possible and hopefully get some of these lenders who are willing to take a risk, who are willing to do something to engage maybe some customers who they're currently not working with to be, you know, part of their system. And in the long run, maybe a really loyal customer that they can have over the long run.
Yeah, through life and over generations within a family. Julie, one of the aspects at CapTimes.com that you mentioned was the story at CapTimes.com was the Catholic churches that make up the St. Vincent de Paul in Madison are, in your words, largely old and white, and you want to reach out to communities of color and those who are most in need. And how are you plan to go about that?
I think it's a challenge for all of us in Madison who, you know, the people who have access to money in Madison are largely older and white people. And so we reach out in this community through similar channels as we all do, the, you know, using social media and our website and advertising and through our members, through our member organization. People find us through 211 as often as they find us any other way. We, for many years, have been the agency in Dane County that receives the most referrals from 211 because we provide programming for people to meet basic needs, food and medicine and housing support and utility bills. And we know that people will continue to find us that way. Yeah. We have been doing intentional outreach and will continue to do so to other agencies represented by people of color, people who are less represented in our community for many years.
And to Julie, we'll have to leave it there, but I thank you so much for joining us today. Julie Bennett's the executive director of the Madison chapter of St. Vincent de Paul, looking to get their microloan program underway in a matter of weeks. Also joining us, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison. Coming up after the news, we take a look at school choice in the state budget. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, some automakers are no longer including AM radio in new vehicles. We'll learn more about the role this broadcast signal plays and a new proposal to keep it in all of our cars. But first, lawmakers are currently in the process of building a state budget proposal for the state legislature. K-12 education funds hang in the balance, including funds dedicated to private schools through the state's voucher programs. Now, these voucher programs use state funds to pay for students from lower-income households to attend some private schools. And according to the nonpartisan nonprofit news outlet Wisconsin Watch, there are 373 schools currently participating in the state's four voucher programs, and 95% of those are religiously affiliated. What do you think about diverting public funds toward private education in the state's school voucher program? Should the state have government spend more money on voucher schools? And would you consider sending your child to a private school if they qualified for these vouchers? What other questions do you have about the state budget in relation to school funding? We'll see what the legislature comes up with and how they reconcile with the governor's proposal in a matter of weeks, I'd imagine. But you can join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Amy Loudenbeck. She's the Director of Policy and Government Affairs for School Choice Wisconsin. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Yeah, so the Wisconsin Coalition for Education Freedom is advocating for a funding increase in the 2023-2025 state budget. What would school advocates, Wisconsin Coalition for Education Freedom, specifically like to see?
Currently, our number one budget priority is to help narrow the gap between what traditional public schools receive and what choice and charter schools receive for an average per pupil payment. Right now, we receive about 60% on average of what our public school counterparts receive. Our schools are investing more than that in the students that they serve. They are fundraising to close that gap. But as public schools go to referendum, as other funding flows to public schools that our schools don't receive, it's creating challenges for us to retain talent and to maintain the seats that we have and grow seats. And we want to advocate for additional funding for our schools. We understand public schools need resources too. It's not an either or, it's an and. And we are making our case to the legislature in the process of the biennial budget.
So Governor Evers proposed a freeze voucher enrollment, but that evidently has been removed by the Joint Finance Committee. You were on the Joint Finance Committee yourself as a member of the State Assembly. So what do you expect to see going forward here, and how do these negotiations usually play out with the experience you've had, Amy?
Well, the negotiations, I think, are certainly coming closer as the voting has begun. But for us, the process started for the coalition well over a year ago to think, what are items that we think we can accomplish in the next biennial budget? For us, we are aware we have divided government. So starting in January, I began to make the rounds and share information. There are so many different types of school choice programs in Wisconsin. You probably know that just public school open enrollment in Wisconsin is one of the most robust programs of its type in the country. We also are the first state to have private school choice. We have charter schools, independent charter schools, and public charter schools. A lot of different types of educational freedom, educational choice in Wisconsin. But articulating that our goals are directed right now to the choice and charter programs, and letting people know that families and schools and communities that they represent, whether you're a Milwaukee Democrat or a Republican from central Wisconsin, to make sure that they can connect the communities and the constituents that they serve with the good work that is going on in their schools, meet the schools, see their students, talk to the families that are benefiting from the program, and really see the value that it has in Wisconsin. And then as the process continues to roll out, start layering more information on them so that when it comes time for a vote, people understand the direct impact that it could have, again, on the communities that they represent, and not just think about public versus private, because again, we understand public schools need resources too. We just want to make sure that our schools are represented and resourced as well.
Amy Loudenbeck, our guest, Director of Policy and Government Affairs for School Choice Wisconsin. And go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Michael in Rice Lake joins us. Michael, you're on the air with Amy Loudenbeck.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess as someone who went to a private school, I went to St. Joseph's Catholic School up here in Rice Lake, and I had some really incredible teachers, and like they're 100% of the reason why I am who I am today. And I think being able to have state funding support these voucher programs allows, you know, people to have access to send their children to schools where they can get an incredible education. And I can remember being in Catholic school where our art program was very, very like short funded because the funding just didn't exist for our private school. And so that had to be compromised in some way. And so I believe 100% that if the state funding for these schools could be increased, it would make an incredible difference in just a lot of children's lives.
Michael, thank you for the call. Let's continue with your calls now. Jennifer in Rice Lake joining us. Jennifer, good afternoon.
Hi there. I would be entirely for private school vouchers if they had to keep all students who cared to attend that school. At this point in time, a private school can deny anyone an education. Public schools do not. The point of having a public school is to educate anyone. So I'd love to see public money used for everyone, not schools that can deny children an education.
Amy, a couple of comments there. One about the teachers and the others about access to some of these choice programs in Wisconsin.
Well, to Jennifer's point, the Wisconsin law on the parental choice program is really clear. It requires private schools in the choice admission choice program to do a blind admission process. Schools do not get to pick students based on their academic achievements or deny students based on any other protected statuses. That is a narrative that is unhelpful. In fact, our schools serve many students with disabilities. Since we created the Special Needs Scholarship Program in 2015, participation has grown in that program by 815% to nearly 2,000 students. A lot of families in the Special Needs Scholarship Program and families attending any of our other schools through the other three programs, many of them have disabilities and are served by our schools.
And to Michael's comment about great teachers and his experience and his support of the more funding for school choice programs across Wisconsin, what does an expanded voucher program look like in Wisconsin? What does that mean from education or for education as you see it, Amy?
Well, we know that in education, there's a very competitive market for quality educators. And those folks do the good work that needs to be done in public schools and in private schools. And when you're looking at, again, a difference of several thousand dollars between which type of school receives what funding, it becomes difficult to retain and attract the talent when the public schools can offer participation in the Wisconsin retirement program or the state health insurance program and potentially offer salaries that are tens of thousands of dollars higher than what our choice schools or charter schools can offer. And so, as the caller said, as Michael said, those teachers in the classroom, it's not just about the money, but we respect the profession and that they have cost of living increases and inflation and other priorities in their household budget too. And they need to be able to make decisions that are best for their families. And so we want to be able to be at least competitive in the education market.
Hey, Amy, thanks as always for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Amy Loudenbeck, Director of Policy and Government Affairs for School Choice Wisconsin. She joined us for a discussion about allocating Wisconsin state budget funds toward private voucher school programs. Coming up, we get to the Basie brass tacks of a Wisconsin question from a listener about the humble tuba and the instrument's place in our hearts. That's ahead on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. And that is Sotto Voce, the quartet, with two euphoniums and two tubas performing the song Power, written by John Stevens. Why? Well, we recently received a question from a listener, Elizabeth Renner from Madison, and she asked,
why are tubas such a prominent part of the UW-Madison band, and why are they so popular in the state of Wisconsin?
Great question, Elizabeth. John Stevens is a longtime tuba performer and composer. In 1985, he joined the faculty of the UW-Madison School of Music, where he led one of the most prestigious low brass studios in the country. He was the tubist with the Wisconsin Brass Quintet and served as the director of the School of Music for 7 years. He retired from the university in 2014 and is now professor emeritus. And he wrote the piece we were just listening to. And Mike Forbes is just one of John's former students at UW and a performer on that recording. He currently plays principal tuba with La Crosse, Beloit Janesville, and Manitowoc Symphonies, and leads Wisconsin's premier large brass ensemble, the Isthmus Brass. He also teaches low brass at UW-La Crosse. Central Time producer Tim Peterson talked with them about Elizabeth's tuba questions.
So before we get to the Madison Marching Band, let's first talk about the popularity of tubas in Wisconsin. John, how did tubas get their start in the Badger State?
I think there's actually a lot of things that led to the popularity these days. The basic German culture of the state, I think, has a lot to do with it. Polka bands, bands and beer, if you will. The musical influences from the German culture have been a big part of that. Then there's also a strong Civil War band tradition in the state that I think all these years later still has sort of carried on. The Broadhead Brass Band, for example, was one of the more well-known bands in the Civil War era. And so that and the German culture and certainly what's happened here at UW-Madison with the popularity statewide of the marching band in particular, you know, people see the tubas and sousaphones all the time and, you know, it's just that's now become part of the culture as well.
And Mike, you've been playing with symphonies around the state. You're currently playing. Could you talk a little bit more about the sort of statewide popularity at the local level?
Sure. There's something about the Midwest and bands in general that they're just much more proliferated around here than they are out east. For example, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and we still have a strong Germanic culture there as well. But somehow the community bands aren't as present as they are in the Midwest. Every little town has its own unique community band or orchestra, even. And in this case, I think a lot of the orchestras I play with kind of grew out of what was a community orchestra and then has become more of a professional orchestra, say, for example, the one in La Crosse and Manitowoc. A lot of this tradition just started, I think, again, from what John was mentioning, that early immigrant idea of having every town having its own brewery, its own band, and its own culture in its little area. Because, you know, travel was difficult, of course, back in those days. Today, we don't even think about crossing the state in a heartbeat. But back in those days, with horse-drawn carriages, you got your entertainment in your local community.
And Mike, our question asker Elizabeth, who moved to Madison a year ago, says since coming here, she feels like everyone she knows someone who plays a tuba, or everyone's dad plays a tuba. Does that sound pretty accurate to you?
Absolutely. I teach actually about 20 students here in the Madison area, private lessons, and about half of those are kids whose dad play the tuba. So there is something to be said about that. Also, anytime I go out and do like a little clinic for kindergartners, I can't tell you, as soon as I come in the door, all these hands shoot up. It's, oh, my dad plays that. And then I said, oh, yeah, what's it called? And they say, it's a trumpet. And I'm like, no, it's a tuba. So
dagger.
There is some confusion sometimes.
Can we circle back to this polka music? How important is the tuba to polka?
I think the tuba is the largest, shiniest, most obvious visual instrument in any polka band. I think that actually has a lot to do with the popularity. I might make the analogy to, you know, the elephants at the zoo. I mean, it's an instrument that catches people's eye and their ear. Also, it's playing the bass line. It's playing something that is going on every second of every piece. You know, I mean, people sing the melodies, but I think there's also this, we all sort of feel this bass line when we're listening to a polka band or a rock band or any kind of band. And the association with the tuba or the sousaphone or both really resonates literally inside of people.
And Mike, you have brought a special guest to the studio, your tuba. Would you mind playing just a little example of this polka bass line?
Sure. I mean, it's just oscillating between sort of what, if you're any kind of a musician, the tonic and dominant for the most part. Something like that.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mike. And we are talking with Mike Forbes, professional tuba player for multiple symphonies in Wisconsin and a low brass teacher at UW-La Crosse. We're also joined by John Stevens, a longtime tuba performer and composer and emeritus professor of music at UW-Madison. And we're answering a Wisconsin question about the popularity of tubas in Wisconsin and the prominence of that instrument in the UW-Madison marching band. And John, let's pivot to talking about that band. Again, our question asker Elizabeth was in awe seeing more than two dozen sousaphone players in UW's band compared with a much smaller number in her band when she was in high school. Why is this instrument such a prominent part of the Badger Band?
Well, this goes back quite a long way. The two most recent directors of the Badger Marching Band put together probably make up something pretty close to a century. Ray Dvorak and then Mike LaCrone have been you know, at the helm of this group for a long, long time. And there have been various stages over the years of the way they used individual instrument sections. I think back in the 50s, the individual, like the trumpets or the trombones or the sousaphones would go into the stands and play and everything. And Mike LeCrone certainly took that tradition and made the most of it in terms of the sousaphone march thing that they do. And again, I think all the things that we've already been talking about contribute to this. They are front and center in the musical part of those football games every week. And, you know, when I first moved here in the 1980s, the UW football program was not especially at the high end of its competency. Mike actually put a lot of the current traditions into place back then, because that's when the whole marching band thing became so popular because, to be honest, for quite a few years there, it was the best thing that people saw and heard at the football game. And so people, when you see a number of sousaphone players walk into a stadium, it's a visual and visceral kind of thing in addition to the sound that you're hearing. So I think folks just... they just love to see it. You know, there's a little bit, the tuba or the sousaphone are kind of underdog instruments too. And, you know, around a lot of the country, the place where we live here in Wisconsin is often referred to as one of the flyover states. So there's a little bit of an underdog attitude perhaps about that too. I just think it's a natural, as Mike said before, here in the Midwest, the fit between the way people consider the tuba and where we live is a good one.
And Mike, you have taught players who have been in this band and you've learned a little bit more about the section. What else can you tell us?
Well, I know that they affectionately call these sousaphones rhinos because of the gigantic horn, you know, so that's and they love that idea. And I think another thing that John was kind of hinting at was that this sousaphone section, which, just for your listener to understand, the tuba is a little different looking than a sousaphone. The tuba is kind of sits on your lap and the bell points upward, whereas a sousaphone wraps around your body and you have the gigantic bell facing right out at the audience. But again, you heard me play some of that polka music where it's kind of this oscillation of two notes. It gets quite boring after a time. But you know, the sousaphones, what made them really special, I think, or the rhinos, I should call them, is that they would actually play, you know, on Wisconsin and these other songs, and they'd actually play the main theme. They'd play the melody. So that was, of course, a hoot. Then when you hear essentially a bass line instrument all of a sudden get their hands on a melody and just squash it, you know, that's a lot of fun to listen to from an audience
it's
perspective.
Like a rhino would.
Exactly.
And some other tuba trivia I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't talk about was, John, you also taught me something as we were setting up this interview, that tuba almost became the official state instrument of Wisconsin.
Yes, that's right. I moved here in 1985, but in 1984, a state senator, I think his name was Carl Oddie, proposed that the tuba become the Wisconsin state instrument. My understanding is that eventually the bill sort of died before it got anywhere. And I also understand that a number of years later, somebody wanted to do the same thing with the accordion. And that also, I don't want to say that it failed, it just sort of never got off the ground. So to the best of my knowledge, there is no official Wisconsin state instrument, but who knows, the day may come where the beloved tuba may have that honor.
I think it's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much, John and Mike.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Renner, we are so glad you asked why Wisconsin. That was Mike Forbes, professional tubist and low brass teacher at UW La Crosse, and John Stevens, longtime tuba performer and composer and professor emeritus of music at UW Madison. Our own Tim Peterson talked with them about the prominence and popularity of the tuba at UW and throughout Wisconsin. This conversation came to us from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. And we invite you to submit all your curiosities. What do you want to know about where we live and what happens here, whether it has to do with our brass, our football team, or maybe a little more on the accordion as our state instrument? What do you say? Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Just go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's WPR.org/Wisconsin. And if you'd like to comment, you can always email us at any time, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Now, coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a project in Oshkosh is converting a former elementary school into affordable housing. Kate Archer Kent will explore adaptive housing solutions with the American Planning Association and find out more about what's happening in Oshkosh right now. Also, meet the Kohler Company's first CSO, that's Chief Sustainability Officer, and find out why the Kohler Company's social impact and environmental sustainability goals are vital to its future and its bottom line. We'll also hear about the new book, Mining the Heartland. Kate Archer Kent will talk with a sociologist who details the cultural struggles and political conflicts of modern-day mining in Minnesota's Iron Range. That's all coming up on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, tomorrow morning from 7 to 9, right here on the Ideas Network. So in the age of texts that autocorrect, the word ducking has become somewhat of an unintended double entendre. Since its release almost 16 years ago, the Apple iPhone's autocorrect has always had its quacks. Nope, sorry, that word is supposed to be quirks. Stupid autocorrect. But not anymore. Yesterday was Apple's annual Worldwide Developers Conference, where they announced new laptops, desktops, operating systems, and a $3,500 virtual reality headset called Apple Vision Pro. But not to be missed in all of the major high-tech gear was a minor update that may make iPhone users more propane. Nope, sorry, that should be profane. Software Chief Craig Federighi said yesterday that Apple will finally update its autocorrect using artificial intelligence to learn when a duck is not a duck. Autocorrected nose you can use. Should be news. This is Central Time. We'll be right back.